Hi, it's Ruth McCauley returning with news from the Decatur area for Thursday, June 16th. As is our practice, we turn to some of the funeral listings that appear in the Decatur Herald and Review. Don Claceris, 83, of Peoria, Illinois, formerly of Decatur, passed away on Sunday morning at his home. His memorial service will be held at the First Federated Church of Peoria at 12 noon. It happened today, and visitation was yesterday at the church. Memorial contributions may be made to the First Federated Church, 3601 North Sheridan Road in Peoria, Illinois, or to the Claceris Family Endowment Fund at Simpson College in Indianola, Iowa. The Davison Fulton Woolsey Wilton Funeral Home was honored to serve the Claceris family. Brandon Richard Breeze, 21, of Decatur, died on Sunday, June 12th, of an accidental drowning at Lake Shelbyville, Illinois. Funeral services will be held at 10 a.m. Saturday, June 18th, at Westside Church of the Nazarene, which is located at 788 North Sunnyside Road in Decatur, area code 62522. With Pastor Lyle Artman officiating, visitation will be held from 6 to 8 p.m. on Friday, that's tomorrow, June 17th, also at the church. Memorials in lieu of flowers may be made to the Brandon Breeze Memorial Fund, care of Busey Bank. Tanzius Logan Funeral Service and Care is in charge of the arrangements. Ronald Howard Goldsboro of North Fort Myers, Florida, and Brownstown, Illinois, passed away on Tuesday, February 23rd, at Cape Coral Hospital after a brief illness. A memorial service will be held at 1 p.m. Saturday, June 18th, at Liberty Christian Church, rural Brownstown, with the Reverend John Heischer officiating. Burial will follow at Liberty Cemetery, with military rites provided by VFW Post 9770 of Brownstown. Visitation will be at noon with a Masonic service by the Argenta Masonic Lodge number 871. Memorials may be made to the Amaranth Diabetes Foundation. Geisiking Claggett Funeral Home in Brownstown is assisting the family with local arrangements. Martiel Marty Trulock, 97, of Polk City, Florida, passed away on June 6th in Lakeland, Florida. A memorial service will be held on Saturday, June 18th, at Winter Haven Christian Church. Charles J. Red Harmon, 88, of Decatur, died on Tuesday, June 14th, at Decatur Memorial Hospital. Funeral services will be conducted at 2 p.m. Saturday, June 18th, at Brentlinger and Earl Funeral Home. Visitation will be tomorrow from 5 to 7 p.m. and from 1 to 2 p.m. on Saturday prior to the service at the funeral home. Burial will be at a later date. Memorial donations may be made to the Grace United Methodist Church. Daisy May Walker, 81, of Sullivan, formerly of Decatur, passed away on Tuesday, June 14th, at Eastview Terrace in Sullivan. Services to celebrate the life of Daisy Walker will be held at noon Saturday, June 18th at Graceland Fairlawn Funeral Home. Visitation will be from 11 a.m. to noon on Saturday at the funeral home, and burial will be in the Graceland Cemetery. Memorial donations may be directed to Alzheimer's Association. Sharon Ruth Mihalik, 61, of Metamora, passed away on June 15th at the Richard L. Owens Hospice Home in Peoria after a long and courageous battle with cancer. The family will have a private memorial celebration of her life, but memorial gifts can be made to the American Cancer Society. The Cremation Society of Mid-Illinois in Pekin, Peoria, is assisting the family with arrangements. We move on now to editorials and opinion pieces, and we begin with the editorial that appears in the Decatur Herald and Review. Fix fire stations, look to future. Decatur's firefighters deserve to work and live in stations that are not subject to leaky roofs, backed up toilets, and other problems. That's why it's significant that the city is starting to address problems at all 7 of the city's fire stations. An architectural firm recently studied the city's stations, as outlined in a story in the Sunday's edition of the Herald and Review, written by reporter Allison Petty, and which showed the 7 stations need a total of $8.1 million in repairs. The firm recommended that 3 stations, Station 3 in Fairview Park, Station 5 near Brentwood Village, and Station 7 at the Decatur Airport, be rebuilt. There is also the possibility that the latter 2 stations could be moved to more strategic locations. Although the city's population has declined, territory is more important than population density. Decatur sprawls over 47 square miles, with each fire station covering about 7 square miles. That allows the fire department to meet the national standard of getting to emergencies in 4 minutes or less, 90% of the time. Decatur's fire stations are responsible for larger territories than any other cities of comparable size. What's intriguing about firefighting, however, is the way their jobs have changed over the years. Fighting structural fires is an important task, but it takes up only a tiny percentage of the calls firefighters answer. In 2015, firefighters responded to 10,317 incidents. Just 268 of those calls were fires. More than half of the calls were emergency response calls. Others included good intent calls, hazardous conditions, and more than 600 false alarms. The number of calls to the fire department has doubled in the last 20 years. That raises questions, most of them unanswerable without further study, about how the fire department should be equipped for the future. For example, would it make sense to have fewer big engines and invest in smaller vehicles to answer calls that don't require full firefighting capabilities? Those sorts of questions should be part of a larger study to align the fire department with the city's current and future needs. However, the fire stations need to be repaired, and that should be the city's first priority. Fortunately, the property tax increase approved by the city earlier this spring included money that could be used to finance bonds to repair and rebuild the fire stations. Not all of the needs are immediate. The architectural firm identified about $1.8 million in repairs that need to be completed in the next 3 years. The building conditions are not due to neglect, but due to aging and a lack of city funds to keep up with maintenance. The stations need to be brought up to a standard that matches the commitment of these first responders. At the same time, the city needs to discuss if there are ways to better equip firefighters for the future. And I'm returning to the Tribune and getting the editor, Paul Osborne's online lead article, which is Observations on Two Places and Five Unnamed People. I stopped to pick up an item at a local service station convenience store on the city's south side early one morning last week. When I pulled into a parking space, I saw that two police officers had two young men handcuffed. One officer was using one of his hands to hold one young man's arm, while he used his other hand to check his pockets. A short distance away, the other officer was processing the other young man in exactly the same way. I walked past the officers and young men as I was heading to the door of the convenience store, and I overheard one of the young men ask, "Don't I have the right to free speech?" He must have been responding to something the officer had told him, but I don't know for sure because that was the only part of the conversation I heard. When I got inside, I asked the cashier what was going on outside. She replied in one word, "Drugs." When I walked out the door and headed to my car, I again walked past the officers and the young men. This time, I heard the same young man I had heard earlier say, I'm not going to jail," with a voice that sounded like he feared that happening. I got into my car and drove off, catching another glimpse in my rearview mirror of the two officers and two young men with uncertain futures. As I grow older, it bothers me even more to see young men with the opportunity to be whatever they want to be, apparently throwing their lives away because of some wrong decisions. Drug usage has become an epidemic indicator and across the nation, and it's leaving so many destroyed lives, families, and potential in its wake. If that was what was really happening to these two young men, what a shame and what a waste. As I drove on towards the newspaper office, I also thought of the police officers who were processing the young men and how often they get little or no respect. I've always felt our police department is the finest anywhere, and while that judgment may be somewhat due to knowing so many of them over the years, it is also backed up by the positive statistics of crime reduction in our community. May God bless them and their efforts, and keep them safe as they keep us safe. Later that day, I paid a visit to the Secretary of State's Later that day, I paid a visit to the Secretary of State's driver's license facility on North Woodford. Fortunately, I noticed that the sticker on the license plate of our newspaper van expired this month, and unlike earlier this year when I had to pay a fine for not noticing the sticker on my infamous car Christine was due, the car didn't warn me. I was much more aware of sticker shock. I don't know anybody who gets up in the morning all excited because they have to go to the driver's license facility for some reason. Tooth extraction may be looked upon more favorably. When I entered the door of the facility, the line that I had to join to reach the person who could help me looked like the TSA lines at O'Hare in Chicago that I've been seeing on television news lately. There is a lot of line bonding that goes on when you are in a long line for the same reason everyone else is in the line, and most of the people seemed pretty patient, unless someone came into the facility and tried to crowd into the line. He was told where to go immediately, the end of the line. It seemed to me the facility was understaffed. There was a lot of numbered counter openings with no one working there, and I attributed that to no state budget and department cuts coming out of Springfield. I'm sure there's a lot of stress and uncertainty on the remaining staff and handling so many people. After what seemed like forever, I finally made it to a counter opening at the west end of the facility. I think it was number 2, but not sure. The state employee who helped was the picture of calmness, friendliness, and help. And after dealing with her, I left the facility with a very positive feeling. Despite everything going on at the state level, she gave great service. As I move through our community each day, I observe a lot of unnamed people experiencing different circumstances, like the 5 I mentioned in this column. I see some bad and some ugly, but I see far more good and beautiful in the people of Decatur, Illinois. I'm proud to live and work here and feel the spirit of this community. That's a nice column. I'm going to stay here with the Tribune and take a letter to the editor written by Marilyn Riley of Decatur, and it carries the headline, City Council Made Errors in Sweeney Gleason Matter. Dear editor, there are several glaring errors in the City Council's handling of the Sweeney Gleason matter. They cannot just say they have no control over the city manager's handling of a personnel matter. They cannot say that Mr. Gleason has done nothing wrong. He obviously asked the former mayor if he could use a city-owned car and driver to get him to the airport. I don't know how the city can view this and say there was no wrong done. If Mr. Gleason did request the use of the car, that is a clear violation of the public trust. I am very disappointed in the council's response to this whole thing. I do not personally know Mr. Sweeney or Mr. Gleason. I do, however, know Mark Bartholomew. If he says Brad Sweeney was a good employee of the city for 20 years, I believe him. For Mr. Gleason to fire Sweeney for no good reason was a black mark on the city council that many of us will remember when the next election comes around. Letter to the editor of the Tribune, signed by Marilyn Riley. Is there another letter here? No. We turn back over to the Herald and Review and pick up a couple letters there. Letter to the editor of the Herald and Review, signed by Roger Campbell of Oriana. Headline, Are Outspoken Folks About to Be Muzzled? I just wonder how much longer it will take our regime to silence our outspoken people, like myself, that speak out against their stupidity. This means the political thieves that have stolen our country blind by selling out to China, Japan, and Mexico. I figure we will be fitted soon with duct tape or muzzles. This doesn't appear to be much of a future for our kids and grandkids. Letter to the editor, signed by Roger Campbell. I wish he'd been a little more specific there. That's just me. The next letter is signed by Robert Jenkins of Macon. Obama doesn't realize the failure of his presidency. Well, I actually made it all the way through the speech our president gave about the Orlando massacre without throwing up. I really wonder if our president could possibly be so stupid that he doesn't realize most of the blame for what happened falls squarely on Barack Obama and the incompetence of his whole administration. He, of course, put most of the blame on gun control and even insinuated Donald Trump might be to blame. Is this Obama character capable of admitting blame for anything? He seems to think he can lie his way out of anything. Well, come to think about it, when it comes to the left-wing voters, they do seem to have a very high gullibility problem. They seem to pretty much believe the garbage Obama and Hillary and Bill Clinton put out. It's a sad situation. As far as some gun control law stopping a terrorist from obtaining a gun, that has to be the worst idiotic idea yet. These people would have zero problems getting whatever weapons they want. Almost as ridiculous was the way CNN commented on Obama's speech. CNN is so unwilling to see this administration for the failure it is. They're so biased, they turn a blind eye toward the way this failed president has treated our military, added more to the national debt than all other presidents combined, has no intention of stopping the graft and incompetence in our veterans' hospitals that is killing our veterans. It's no wonder CNN's viewers have dropped rapidly. People are waking up to their biased reporting, and they're covering up the failures of Barack Obama. Again, this is a letter to the editor of the Decatur Herald and Review, signed by Robert Jenkins of Macon. We're still in the Decatur Herald and Review and have an article out of Washington, D.C., written by an Associated Press writer by the name of Ricardo Alonso Zaldivar, and it's about Medicare drug ideas. So I think that might be of interest. Medicare drug ideas offer pluses and minuses. Calling the rising cost of drugs unsustainable, congressional advisors Wednesday recommended major changes to Medicare's popular outpatient prescription program, now 10 years old. The proposal from the nonpartisan Medicare Payment Advisory Commission, or MedPAC, steers clear of calling for the government to negotiate drug prices directly, an option both presidential candidates advocate. For beneficiaries, the plan is a mixed bag. All seniors would get better protection from extremely high costs, but some may have to spend more. The recommendations are unlikely to gain traction in Congress during an election year, but they will get a serious look from staff experts on key House and Senate committees overseeing Medicare. MedPAC is a congressional agency charged with making regular recommendations on Medicare, the government's premier health insurance program, with 57 million elderly and disabled beneficiaries. Echoing widespread concerns about drug costs, MedPAC said spending for Medicare's prescription program grew by nearly 60% from 2007 through 2014, from $46 billion to $73 billion. That was driven by spending on high-cost beneficiaries who tend to use the most expensive medications, such as the recent breakthrough cures for hepatitis C infection. Congress should re-examine the program's design to, quote, better ensure financial sustainability, end quote, the commission has written. The MedPAC proposal would protect all seniors by setting an annual limit on how much they can be required to pay for medications, a new safeguard. However, it would also raise costs about $1,000 for some beneficiaries who land in the widely loathed coverage gap known as the donut hole. And MedPAC also proposed restructuring modest co-payments that low-income beneficiaries may face in order to encourage greater use of generic and preferred brand name drugs. Insurance companies, the middlemen who deliver coverage to some 39 million beneficiaries in the prescription program, aren't likely to be very pleased. The MedPAC plan wouldn't change the share of total program costs subsidized by the government, which is roughly three-fourths, but a change in the payment formula would put insurers more directly on the hook for managing spending on the priciest drugs. That could expose the companies to greater financial risk. Currently, after a beneficiary reaches what's called the catastrophic threshold of the benefit, taxpayers are responsible for 80% of the cost of drugs. The insurer's share is 15%, and the beneficiary pays 5%. That threshold is about $7,500 this year, counting spending both by the patient and by the insurer. Under MedPAC's proposal, beneficiaries would no longer have to worry about how to keep paying that 5%, which can be substantial, with some drugs costing $100,000 a year. Instead, the beneficiary's exposure would be limited to about $4,850. Insurers, however, could face a potential downside. MedPAC concluded that the current formula doesn't give insurers much incentive to drive bargains with pharmaceutical companies, since Medicare picks up 80% of the cost of catastrophic coverage. The plan calls for gradually dialing down the government share to 20%. Drug companies may not like that either, since insurers would demand bigger rebates. It could also pressure pharmaceutical companies to restrain prices for new drugs. While the complex proposal involves major restructuring, Medicare would not negotiate with drug makers. In many other economically advanced countries, the government is actively involved in setting prices, leading to lower costs for consumers. The drug industry says if the U.S. takes that road, it could reduce their investment in research and development. But in this election year, both presidential candidates have called for some form of direct negotiation by Medicare. For Republican Donald Trump, that stance puts him at odds with Republican congressional leaders opposed to the government setting drug prices. MedPAC said its entire package would save an estimated $2 billion annually and $10 billion over 5 years. It's a complicated issue. No doubt about that. There's a quick local note listed in the local section of the Decatur Herald and Review about what's happening with the Decatur Park District. Well, their Board of Commissioners formally approved its budget and appropriation ordinance yesterday. The board had previously given its tentative approval to the spending plan, which includes $14.2 million in operating expenses. No one spoke at a public hearing before the vote. Commissioner Stacy Young was absent, and the other commissioners voted unanimously in favor of that budget. So, they're off and running out at the Park District, as is usual. We're about out of time for today. News from the Decatur area for Thursday, June 16th. This has been Ruth McCauley reading with you. I'm going to be gone for a few weeks, taking a little vacation, which I must admit I sorely need. You all are swell. I'm so glad you listened to news from Decatur, and I hope you enjoy the readings and that they're helpful to you. It's been a pleasure, as always. This is Ruth McCauley signing off. Hope to be back with you in a couple weeks. And until then, y'all take care.